Sponsorship of the Be Our Guest podcast is brought to you by the wisdom of Walt. Put Walt to work for you. We are deep in the holiday season right now, and the best thing to do for that Disney fan on your gift list is to put some Disney right in their hand. And you can do that with the wisdom of Walt. It's subtitled Leadership Lessons from the Happiest Place on Earth. This book is not only a history lesson of Disneyland, but it also really gets you in touch with Walt Disney himself. And the author, Jeff Barnes, really gives us lessons that Walt left us in Disneyland to improve our careers and everything in our life. You know, I think Disney fans are looking to be inspired, but also looking to connect to Walt Disney and the Disney parks themselves. And that's the best way to do that is with the Wisdom of Walt. So check it out today. You can grab it on Amazon, but the best way to do this in the holiday season, let's do it right. Drop by thewisdomofwalt.com and pick up a personally signed copy and put it under the tree this year. Again, drop by thewisdomofwalt.com and make this a Christmas season that your Disney fan won't forget. Again, thewisdomofwalt.com. Today's show is also proudly sponsored by our friends over at touringplans.com. They're the folks who keep you out of lines and see the most amount of attractions possible on the next Walt Disney World, Disneyland, or Universal vacation. I want to ask you today to drop by touringplans.com and check out all the great free stuff that helps you plan that next Disney getaway. One of the things you can do is to check out the room views right there. They have many, many room views from the Walt Disney World resorts. If you're staying over at, say, Caribbean Beach and you want to get a pirate room, you want to know what it looks like from one of those rooms, hey, you can do that right there for free on their site. You can also have them fax in room requests for you, which are highly successful. Let me tell you, I've been using that here over the past few months, and it is a powerful tool to get those requests that you're looking for on your next Disney vacation. Check them out. Support the folks who support us. It's going to make your next Disney vacation awesome. Check them out today over at touringplans.com.
Ready to take a trip to the world? You found the Be Our Guest Walt Disney World Trip Planning Podcast. This is where your memories come front and center on our podcast stage.
Welcome to episode 1105 of the Be Our Guest Walt Disney World Trip Planning Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rallman, for BeOurGuestPodcast.com and MagicalMouseRadio.com. Happy Monday to you. Whew, like 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks till Christmas. The pressure's on, guys. Got to get those gifts. And today we might have another idea for the Disney fan in your life. We're going to have a great time talking about what could have happened. What could have been? I feel like Tiffany. What could have been down at Walt Disney World? We have a great time with author Chris Smith from down in Huntsville, Alabama. But joining me today, a special treat on a Monday. That's right. She cleared her schedule and made it happen. We have Ricky from a DisneyWorldAfterAll.com, TouringPlans.com, and The Mouse for Less. What's going on, Ricky? It's a Monday.
Well, I don't know about you. Yeah, it is a Monday, and I don't know about you, but I just celebrated Christmas. So Christmas is over for me.
did you do the Southwest Missouri Christmas already?
We did. We went down to visit the in-laws and had fun. So had a good time with the family and, you know, coming home. And it's so nice to go down to that area and spend time with the in-laws. I just have to say, I have a great time whenever I go.
Apparently, too,
it's just a good time.
We're seeing rumors that the Osborne Lights may be down in Branson, Missouri next holiday season. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? I don't know. I will wait until I see more permanent news on that. So better pictures. And I don't think that's going to come until next year because they aren't coming until 2017, no matter what it is. So sure. That'll be interesting.
We got Matt Parrish on that beat. He's down there in Southwest Missouri checking it out for us. All right. So let's get to the star of today's show. We have Mr. Chris Smith from down in Huntsville, Alabama, the author of The Walt Disney World That Never Was. We're going to talk about those resorts and those attractions down at Walt Disney World that could be there today, but they're not. And we'll talk about why I think every Disney fan is curious about this. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate you all having me on. Let me just say, if the Osborne Lights show up anywhere else, I'll be there, no matter how far it is from Huntsville.
There you go. There you go. Hey, I have to say, I've been to Silver Dollar City. It's a nice theme park. So if that's where it's headed, it's going to be real nice, I have to say.
So it's worth the trip right there.
Hey, I'm
it's
in.
It's worth the trip.
That'd be a cool meetup for everybody down in Branson. I think that'd be a good time.
They got caves there. It's pretty awesome, I have to say. You get to go down in the cave. I don't know how cold it would be, you know, in Christmas time. But
no, they're the
I
same.
Know they have the caves.
Yeah, that's the Merrimack Caverns. It says same temperature year round, 60 degrees.
That's
kind
true.
Of the thing that's painted on all the barns. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to Chris's book and let's talk about the Walt Disney World that never was, because I think that, you know, as Disney fans and everybody, even the folks that are, you know, come from across the pond, from anywhere around the world, we go down to Walt Disney World and we see all the great attractions and we love, you know, how themed it is and how great the cast members are and how beautiful the resorts are and how they can take us to places we may never go in our lifetime. You know, you stay at the Polynesian, but you may never take a trip to Polynesia itself out in the Pacific. But there's so many other experiences when you read this book that, oh man, I really wish I could, you know, take a gondola ride through a Venetian type resort right on the monorail loop, stuff like that. And it leaves me wondering, why didn't these things happen? So Chris, you wrote this book and this was kind of the focus of, you know, what could have been down at Walt Disney World and why these things may or may not have happened. So what gave you the inspiration to sit down and put pen to paper and write a book like this?
Sure. So, you know, I think first and foremost, it starts with, you know, I just love Walt Disney World. I mean, I really do. And my day job is I'm a corporate attorney here in Huntsville, Alabama. And for those who aren't aware, Huntsville is kind of not what most people think of when it comes to the state of Alabama. It's kind of a very high tech, almost, you know, Silicon Valley light type city. But I actually grew up in a very small town called Speke, Alabama, not too far from here. And it's, you know, what most people do think of, which is, you know, very rural area, a lot of farms, a lot of pastures. But growing up as a child in that environment, it was just great, because, you know, my imagination just kind of carried me and took me all over the place. And when my family finally scraped together enough money to take us to Walt Disney World for the first time when I was 7, man, I was just, you know, completely hooked from the get-go. And, you know, I tell a lot of friends, and I joke about that, I think, you know, Disney fanatics like me and like both of you, I'm sure, we kind of go through different phases where you kind of become the, you know, the neighborhood Disney guy or girl for a while. And for a lot of people, it stops at that. But, you know, unfortunately for my wife, I wanted to take it a step further. And this is kind of a, you know, a Disney nerd confession, but I figure I'm gonna save place here. I started collecting these annual shareholder reports of the Disney company. And, you know, as a corporate attorney, that both makes sense and is completely sad, you know, in of itself. But but what's interesting about those reports, and for those who don't know, an annual report is a corporate document that the Disney company puts out yearly to its shareholders that kind of, you know, describes the past year's operations and then kind of looks forward. Back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, when you start reading through these, you see these references to these just fantastic and amazing concepts, like a Thunder Mesa or like these wonderful Seven Seas Lagoon resorts that never came to be. And as I started reading those, it just was a topic that just absolutely fascinated me. And so I decided to do a little more digging to try to find out, you know, why these experiences, these attractions never came to be.
And one of the things when I was reading the book that keeps coming back when we, you know, get into the attractions that didn't happen and the shows that, you know, they seemed like they were going to be a surefire, you know, big, yeah, huge deal in the parks, like, the, you know, Dick Tracy over at the studios, and then the movie, yeah, doesn't hit, you know, like they thought it would, or, you know, Jim Henson's untimely death while the Muppets deal was just getting sealed. And that was going to be such a, again, another huge part of Disney's Hollywood Studios or MGM back in the day. You know, sometimes just it's so close that it was really literally like within arm's reach, and then it doesn't happen. But one of the things that comes back, you know, through the book that I see is that, and this is so true, is that, you know, a lot of times Walt Disney and the Imagineers would sit down and have these, you know, blue sky sessions. They would call them gag sessions. They would sit there and talk about things that could be. And the thing is that with Disney, a good idea doesn't die. It may sit for decades, but you know what? Something you talk about back in the 70s not happening, it could happen in 2020. I mean, do you kind of feel that same way?
Absolutely, Mike. And that's, you know, I would say that's probably the number one overarching, you know, theme of the book, is that good and great ideas never truly die. You know, I think one of the most exciting things as a Disney fan today is when we hear about these new attraction concepts and these new theme park lands that are coming out. And certainly, you know, Disney's kind of going, you know, full steam ahead on a lot of fronts with Pandora and Disney's Animal Kingdom, and of course the Star Wars and Pixar expansions going on at the studios. But you know, really, in my mind, when you kind of look at the history of the Disney Company and the Walt Disney World Parks, kind of the best predictor of things that are to come are to look back at these great ideas that never came to be, because a lot of times those ideas morph and evolve and change over time and then end up resulting in what we see in the parks today. And another point is, you know, some of the best attractions that I enjoy today, like a Big Thunder Mountain Railroad or a Splash Mountain, you know, a lot of folks may not understand that those attractions actually trace their roots back to another monumental type concept that never came to be. And it's just, it really is a fascinating topic when you start digging through these ideas and these attractions that for whatever reason, never actually made it off the drawing board and into the Disney parks.
And one of those things that, you know, I think is very timely right now is, you know, the hottest attraction at Walt Disney World right now is Frozen Ever After over at Epcot. You know, long wait times, high demand for FastPass Plus, and every family wants to check it out on their Walt Disney World vacation. Yet the Imagineers had this, you know, almost ready to go decades before. So can you tell us about that?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, one of my favorite Imagineers of all time was a gentleman named Mark Davis, and that name may not ring a bell for a lot of the regular Disney fans, but certainly his work is known by everyone. He started with the Disney Company in the 30s as an animator, one of Walt's nine old men, one of his fundamental animators. And Mark brought to life, you know, just these wonderful characters such as Cinderella and Aurora and Maleficent from Sleeping Beauty and Tinkerbell, and just, you know, the list goes on. Developed a reputation within the Disney Company as kind of the go-to animator for noteworthy female characters. Alice from Alice in Wonderland is another one. And so Mark eventually moved over to kind of designing attractions for the Disney parks, beginning with Disneyland and then later in Walt Disney World. And In the 70s, Mark developed an idea for, and I'm really not overselling this because I really get excited about this concept, what may have been the most beautiful attraction ever created by Disney. And it was called the Enchanted Snow Palace. And it was based upon the same Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale that Frozen, the animated film, was based upon, you know, many years later. And so Mark developed kind of these plans for this massive show building that would have been in Fantasyland. And, you know, it would have kind of been like a large glacier, white and blue glacier, in the heart of Fantasyland, and would have included a dark ride, boat ride type attraction through melted ice, and would have taken guests past these numerous, you know, fun scenes with polar bears and ice fairies and different type wintry characters before finally coming across the Snow Queen herself. And one of the things that makes me so excited about that concept was Mark Davis created a number of beautiful artistic renderings about the attraction that are out there in a number of different works, including his own book. And, you know, it's just amazing to me to think about this wonderful, beautiful attraction that could have been, you know, decades before the Frozen Frenzy really took off. Eventually, the attraction itself was shelved, you know, primarily for cost reasons. And, you know, as you read the book, you see, unfortunately, that the primary reason a lot of these concepts never came to be is because, you know, they're so great, they're also so expensive. And at that time, there was also a push to develop more, you know, adult/teen attractive experiences. And so Fantasyland already included a number of different family-style dark rides that the entire family could enjoy. But, it kind of breaks my heart when I look back at these artistic renderings and think about, man, how gorgeous that could have been there in Fantasyland.
Yeah, it's so true because, you know, to me, I still think Frozen is a great fit for Fantasyland. I mean, it's a fantasy story. You know, I think it's better than World Showcase and Epcot. Now, they made it work with the Norwegian, you know, culture and so forth. But, I mean, do you agree, Chris, that it to me, it still seems like a better fit in Fantasyland, if I could pick?
Yes, and I'll say, you know, my wife and I took our twins down to Walt Disney World a couple of weeks ago, and we got to experience the Frozen attraction in Norway, and it is... I was very impressed and surprised in a lot of respects. Think it's a very fun attraction, but thematically, in my opinion, I think it would just be so much better of a fit in Fantasyland, just because it has those kind of, you know, components of a Snow White type attraction, or a the wonder of a Peter Pan type film that, you know, for me would have been a little bit better of a tie-in thematically.
Agree. So I'm going to let Ricky jump in here in just a second. I want to ask you about one other part here that I have dog ear before I hit the resorts at the end. And it's the whole Epcot, you know, story. And, you know, most of our listeners do know that Epcot was originally planned by Walt Disney to be this utopian city where he really kind of took urban planning to the next level and, you know, had this entire city figured out in his mind to where it was everything was going to be efficient and everything was going to be clean and everything was going to be the way a city should if you could start from scratch. And of course, Walt Disney's untimely death kind of led to the folks that had to carry on to decide, what do you do with this? So looking back on that, Chris, what do you think? I mean, the idea of this utopian city, which in a way, you know, way down the line, decades later, you got Celebration, which wasn't exactly even really close. It was just a planned community outside of Walt Disney World. But would this idea have worked if Walt could have said, you know, if he would have lived maybe 10 more years? What do you think?
You know, Mike, that's an extremely difficult question to answer. You know, I think those of us who have looked at it, we know that kind of the heart and the soul of the entire Florida project for Walt was Epcot, the city. And, you know, if you want just a great piece of Disney nostalgia, go and watch the Epcot film that was filmed back in 1966. And you just see the exuberance and the joy of Walt. That just, man, I tell you, sometimes, you know, this is another Disney nerd confession, but if I'm having a bad day, sometimes I'll just watch that to kind of get a boost of energy and enthusiasm. So there's no doubt that Walt's love for Epcot was a pushing force for the entire Florida project. The problem is, and I think you saw this with the Disney company, kind of the struggles they faced with what to do about Epcot when Walt unfortunately passed away in 1966, is, you know, how in the world do you make it work? And Walt laid out in the Epcot film, you know, in explicit detail, you know, what he thought Epcot should be. You know, this large business center surrounded by these high density multifamily units and a green space and even a suburban area, and you know, but the problem is how do you actually make that work, and how do you actually generate revenue from that? And, you know, Walt's original concept called for, you know, upwards of 20,000 people to actually live in this Epcot city. And, you know, as we saw with the Disney executives and Imagineers in the wake of his death, they just struggled for many years thereafter about how to actually turn that original concept into a concept that would work at Walt Disney World. And, you know, I'm kind of doing the classic attorney, you know, evading the question. I don't know. You know, I think Walt had a proven track record of coming up with amazing ideas and then making those amazing ideas work, notwithstanding everyone else's doubts. So I would always put my money on Walt being able to get something done. But my goodness, he may have been the only person who could have done that, because certainly the folks left behind after him had to change things up to kind of get Epcot off the ground.
Do you think Epcot as it stands right now is the best that they could have done, you know, given the circumstances of we're left with this visionary who's no longer with us, and he has this just, you know, grandiose plan, which would have been amazing. Yeah. But I mean, when you're left without the visionary, what do you do?
That's right. You know, I struggle with that because I love Epcot in a lot of ways today, and I think in a lot of ways it needs improvement. You know, kind of the story of how the Epcot we see today came to be is an interesting one too, just because you had these two different concepts of this World Showcase type area, which as you'll see in the book, was going to be a standalone theme park concept in of itself on the Seven Seas Lagoon, believe it or not. And then combining that with this future world concept, you know, I don't know. It's kind of hard to stay completely loyal to that original concept when you're really shifting direction in terms of how you're going to make money as a company with an amusement park. But I think there's room for improvement, and I think in the Destination D conference that happened recently, the comments of Disney officials there, I think we're about to see a revamp of Future World especially. And I think in those comments they say they're going to stay loyal to what that original vision was. So I'm going to kind of take a step back and see what actually comes of that.
Sorry, I laugh at that because, you know, when you think about obviously what the concept of Epcot was, and the fact that the first sentence out of their mouth was basically it's going to be Disney, you know, those two things, when you really know what the concept of Epcot was, those two things they're super, because, you know, Disney now is all about IP, so those two things don't really go together. Like, I think the old Disney, where they were able to create, you know, new attractions based off of, you know, ideas that they came up with that didn't involve IP, yeah, I definitely think that Disney company could totally, totally mesh those two together. But I don't think that this Disney company can, so I don't know.
Yeah, and really, you know, if you kind of, you know, in my mind, if you look at Walt Disney World as a whole, you know, I think your best kind of things you see that are good references to Walt's original vision are just the monorail itself, and then the TTA, the people mover in Tomorrowland. You know, even though they're just, you know, they're, the monorail is certainly a transportation mode, and the TTA is an attraction. Those are going to be key transportation concepts in Epcot, the city itself. So I always make sure that each time I visit the Magic Kingdom, especially, I take a ride through, and then also get a nice look at that Progress City model that's in there as well.
Yeah, so true. Could you imagine if the TTA was actually used as a transportation system rather than just an attraction as it is today? I mean, that would, it's clean, you know, it's efficient, and man, that'd be such, could you imagine just having a way to get around not only like a huge theme park like Epcot, you know, to get from back to front, but also just maybe, you know, if we're really looking grandiose, you know, around the Walt Disney World Resort instead of buses, you know, just hopping on one of those and bam, you know, go where you need to go. This is the kind of stuff I love thinking about, you know, because what could have been, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah, and listen, I love the subject because I've written a book about it. But for me as a Disney fan, I just think these concepts are fascinating, and the story behind them, and really, you know, the story of a lot of these attractions and concepts are the story of the Disney company itself, and the company's response to different circumstances and events like Walt's death or economic conditions that the entire world is facing that the Disney company has to in turn respond to. It's certainly, you know, fascinating concepts to think about.
Yeah, totally. All right, Ricky. So what intrigues you about stuff that, you know, could have been down at Walt Disney World, but, you know, still not there today, maybe someday in the future?
Well, you know, I think that kind of what he was talking about, you know, economic things that can cause issues. You know, one of the things that you were talking about earlier that has always intrigued me ever since I learned about it was, you know, Thunder Mesa. And, you know, you said this is also a Mark Davis concept, and, you know, the fact that was something that had a few things not happen. You know, first of all, the, you know, kind of the whole oil problem back in the 70s. And then, of course, then you have the fact that people were basically begging, wondering where on earth Pirates of the Caribbean was. You know, it makes me wonder, I've always wondered, you know, how the park would have been different if Thunder Mesa had gotten built, because it would have been, you know, a Pirates of the Caribbean for the Magic Kingdom, just a different form. It would have included some very unique things, such as some really cool audio animatronics, a really cool story, a different story. that's one thing that has always intrigued me is Thunder Mesa, and I've always been sad, and I don't think it will ever come to fruition because they have built Big Thunder Mountain Railroad and Splash Mountain in that spot.
Yeah, and I'll just tell you, oh my goodness, Thunder Mesa. Oh.
I know. What
a concept that would have been, because I mean, think about this, guys. I mean, you had, again, Mark Davis, who I truly believe is one of the most brilliant Imagineers that has ever been a part of the Disney company. And this is the goal that Mark Davis set for himself in putting together plans for Thunder Mesa. Create the greatest attraction that the Disney company has ever seen. In other words, he wanted to out-pirate his previous masterpiece, Pirates of the Caribbean, from Disneyland. And Mark absolutely poured his heart and soul into developing plans for Thunder Mesa. And, you know, most folks are under the misconception that Thunder Mesa was an actual attraction. It wasn't. It was really a sub area of Frontierland that would have gone from kind of the footprint today where you see the Briar Patch at Splash Mountain all the way through the current footprint of Big Thunder Mountain. I mean, just this monumental four-story Monument Valley type landscape that would have included, you know, numerous attractions. Number one, a runaway mine train attraction that we did eventually get with Big Thunder Mountain Railroad. And if you think about kind of the time period, that would have been significant in that it would have been the very first thrill ride for the Magic Kingdom and the first roller coaster. But the true star of Thunder Mesa, and what would have been, I think, the signature attraction for all of Walt Disney World, would have been the Western River Expedition, which would have essentially been a Wild West version of Pirates of the Caribbean. Now, what makes this concept to me just so, you know, just breathtaking is that it would have included, you know, upwards of 150 different audio animatronic characters. And by comparison, Disneyland's version of Pirates, and you know, has about 100. So just this huge amount of audio animatronics. And goodness gracious, it would have been fantastic. Did not come to be for a lot of different reasons. And Ricky, you hit on it. It's amazing to me when you kind of look back at the planning process for the Magic Kingdom, because at that point in time, the only Disney park around is Disneyland. And so you see Disney executives and Imagineers struggling with, you know, they want to balance creating new attractions and experiences, but also including some of those already popular at Disneyland to kind of, you know, bring folks in and capitalize on what was already there. For whatever reason, they decide not to include a Pirates of the Caribbean attraction. And, you know, it's interesting, they drop a line in one of their shareholder reports that specifically, you know, states that they thought that folks would be taking a trip to Florida in conjunction with a trip to the Caribbean, which, you know, sounds a little strange to me. And so they thought that a Pirates ride just would not have the popularity as it did in California. Well, as you just mentioned, as soon as the park opened, guest relations and poor cast members start getting pelted with questions. Well, you know, where are the Pirates? Where's the Pirates ride? Yeah. To the point where the president of the company, Carl Walker, has to put Imagineers, you know, specifically Mark Davis himself, on to creating an abbreviated version of Pirates to meet that guest demand. And that, compounded with cost and then some other, you know, really crazy reasons, we just never got the Thunder Mesa concept. But, you know, just tons of beautiful artistic renderings that Davis and his team put together about what would have been included. And, you know, if you can't tell, I've really got a soft spot in my heart for that concept, because I think it really would have been fantastic. When you have a brilliant mind like that set such a high goal for themselves of create the best thing we've ever done, I just would have loved for him to have gotten a chance to do that.
Yeah, it's amazing when you look back, man. That could have changed the whole landscape of the Magic Kingdom. It would have been a different park in itself.
Yeah, and I will say too, Mike, just quickly, I am a bit torn on the whole concept, because I will admit that two of my favorite attractions, the two of my family's favorite attractions today, are Big Thunder Mountain Railroad and Splash Mountain.
Yep.
And if Thunder Mesa had been built, then, you know, we would have had some type of mine train, but not exactly what we have today. And who knows what would have happened with Splash Splash Mountain. So it's kind of that, you know, that double-edged sword where, you know, goodness gracious, you'd have loved to have seen this Thunder Mesa concept, but, you know, you may have had to sacrifice a couple of the attractions that we do enjoy today.
Man, so much to talk about. I love this stuff. You know, one of the things I wanted to touch on was, you know, you don't think about how, you know, external factors outside of the Vacation Kingdom, you know, as Walt Disney World was called in the 70s, you know, that it changes the landscape. You know, you have things like the oil embargo that Ricky mentioned from the 70s that they kept a lot of these monorail resorts from being built, because obviously when, you know, the gas prices spiked, tourism dropped because not that many people were coming via, you know, plane. Everybody was driving down, or a lot of people were still driving down at that time, and it just became economically, you know, intolerable to afford the gas to get down there. And then you have the September 11th attacks that brings, you know, the second half of Pop Century to a halt. And that shell of a building sits there for, you know, a good 10 years before they, you know, tear some of it down and turn some of the building that's standing into the Little Mermaid rooms over at Art of Animation. So there's just, it's just, I love this.
Yeah,
I mean, even, you know, the stall
that's kind of a, you know, I've been practicing law for 12 years, and I tell our new attorneys that, you know, unfortunately, what we do is not just about the practice of law. You know, it's actually a business, right? You have to run that business and make money on that business. And even though I don't like to think about it this way, the Walt Disney Company is the same way, right? I mean,
right.
It's this fantastic land of joy and hope and innocence and wonder. But, you know, there is a company behind that, you know, has to be run as a company and make money and certainly respond to different economic conditions that are going on in the world. So it's that's one of those, you know, that you know, it's certainly interesting to read about, but sometimes you don't want to think about that as a diehard Disney fan.
You don't. I mean, but, you know, even in, because, again, I haven't been a fan as long as you. You know, I kind of came around in the late 90s. But, you know, as you think of, you know, for a while there, Port Orleans French Quarter, as we know it now, back in the day, it was just called Port Orleans Resort. You know, that entire resort was shuttered. I mean, it was off the, you could not book it. You know, they just, the people weren't traveling, and the way that the Disney company saved money, they just closed the entire resort, and they closed, you know, buildings and other resorts, or, you know, entire floors. And, you know, even for somebody that kind of stuff, you know, because right now the times are good, and, you know, the inventory of hotel rooms is low and the prices are up. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that it was a whole different ballgame.
That's right. And I will say, Mike, that, you know, that early 70s oil embargo, boy, that's the one that really gets me, because these Seven Seas Lagoons resorts that we could have seen, in addition to the Contemporary and the Polynesian, you know, it was the Venetian, the Asian, and the Persian resorts. My goodness, I think those would have been amazing resort facilities, just intricately themed and breathtaking to look at and a joy to stay at. But, you know, once the oil embargo was in place and the trickle down effect that had on the U.S. economy and certainly the ability of people to pay for vacations, those fantastic resort concepts unfortunately got shelved also.
It's crazy how things outside of that just definitely changed the plans for decades to come. So one of the things that I, you know, as I was reading the book, this is where I felt like really close to you when I was reading it, because when I travel the monorail loop and I go on that, you know, you're going in that section between the TTC and the Contemporary, you got that beautiful wooded area, you know, and sometimes you'll even see a deer or two as you're passing over. You'll see wildlife down there, which for somebody that's from the city, you know, seeing a deer is pretty big deal. It's pretty cool. But, you know, that is a spot where they're going to put a great hotel, but they've driven pilings in there for tests. And unfortunately, that land right now is not stable for a hotel, but man, I love
that's right.
For what that could
that's
have been.
Right. So initially it was going to be that Venetian hotel that was patterned off the city of Venice, where you would literally have this network of canals within the resort. I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, going down there with your significant other, you know, this beautiful resort, fine Italian dining options, and then just, you know, gondola rides throughout the resort itself. That, you know, I would certainly be booking that vacation as soon as I could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I heard Jim Hill. Ricky, did you mention, Jim did a show with Len probably within the last year. Again, all rumors, but I mean, we're Disney fans. We love what could have been. We love the rumors, you know, what might be, who knows. But I heard rumors that they're even, you know, I don't know how far along this has gotten, but possibly moving the TTC over to that Stallport area and then using that piece of land for a resort hotel, which would be ultra deluxe. Yeah, so
that was Jim Hill.
I mean, it sounds like that'd be something you'd go for.
I love Jim and Lynn. Those guys are great. And Jim's Wild Four columns, that for a guy like me who love these kind of concepts, I ate those up. But you just kind of wonder, that's such a prime piece of real estate. And, literally the ground is so swampy that when they drove these test pilings into the ground, they just literally sank. Because even after the Venetian concept was shelved, after the success of the Grand Floridian, Michael Eisner wanted to move forward with a Mediterranean type concept that would be patterned after this Greek island, and still they just could not, the ground was just not stable enough, and you just wish that there was something they could do that was, I'm sure, certainly economics plays a large role into that. Something they could do to make that piece of property work to get another great hotel there.
Interesting stuff. Well, I'm sure
Disney wants to get another hotel there, because that means ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching.
You mean they want to?
Right. We actually, my family and I just stayed at the Contemporary Resort, it's actually, I've stayed at most resorts on property. That was actually our first time at the Contemporary, and we loved it. We love those resorts. The proximity to the parks, to the Magic Kingdom is so great, especially when you have small kids. So we would be all for as many other resorts we could get there on the Lagoon Loop.
Yeah, there's so much more in the book. I mean, you got all the stuff over at Animal Kingdom with Beastly Kingdom. You got the World Showcase countries that could have been. We could have had the Soviet Union. We could have had St. Peter's Square. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff.
Can you imagine a recreation of Red Square there at World Showcase? My goodness, that would have been just fantastic.
And that's why this book, it's great for your imagination, because a lot of this stuff, if you haven't seen artist renderings, you're just picturing, okay, could I see, the Soviet Union squeezed in there between Morocco and Japan? Where would it go? What would it look like? That's kind of stuff that really gets you daydreaming. But let me ask you this, Chris, before we get out of here on a Monday. What's, I know Thunder Mesa is dear to your heart. You can tell in the book that's something you really, you can feel like you're paying, man. You wanted that. But excluding that, a resort or a themed area or an attraction, if you could bring one of these things, the Iger comes to you and says, I'm on my way out. I'm going to grant you one wish. We're going to do one of these things that never happened. What would you ask him to put in Walt Disney World today?
Well, this is something that a lot of folks may be surprised about, just in terms of my personal preference. But this Roger Rabbit's Hollywood area that was strongly considered for Disney Studios, I think would have been just a great addition. Folks forget how amazingly popular the Who Framed Roger Rabbit film was back in 1988, I believe it was. Second highest grossing film of the year behind Rain Man. And really, as I say in the book, a lot of folks argue that it was that film as opposed to The Little Mermaid that started this animation renaissance. But the characters were great. The time period of 1940s golden era Hollywood was a perfect tie-in with the Disney Studios. And kind of what really gets me is there were so many attractions that were proposed for that area. You had this Baby Herman's Baby Buggy Ride, Dark Ride, a Toontown Trolley Simulator, a Benny the Cab Ride. I have no doubt that it would have been wildly successful there, but because of, as I talk about in the book, a disagreement between the Disney Company and Michael Eisner on one side, and then Amblin Entertainment and Steven Spielberg on the other side, who they had partnered with to make the film, it just never came to be. But I always think, because there's some Roger Rabbit hidden gems there in Disney Studios that we talk about that can be seen there today, every time I'm there and I see those, I think, man, that would have been, what a great addition that would have been to the parks.
Means so much. So everybody needs to pick up this book seriously for the Disney
yes,
fan, for yourself.
I can't wait to read this.
If you're listening to this show, you need this for real. You're going to have a little downtime here during the holidays. Check
Absolutely.
It out.
Absolutely. Hello, Christmas present.
Exactly. I'm saying. I mean, books are great to have because you can read them over and over. And that's what I've already read it twice. So, Chris, where can people find you on the social media? And more importantly, where can they pick up a copy of the book here?
Sure, they can get me on Twitter at Disney Kid again. I tell folks that I like that name because after having visited Disney World dozens, even hundreds of times, I've realized what I'm sure you all have realized is that Disney is more than just bricks and mortar. It's more than hamburgers and hot dogs. It's truly a magical place where dreams come true, and where adults, even corporate attorneys like me, can become kids again. And then for the book, you can get it on Amazon and my publisher, Theme Park Press, Bob McLean, his website, which not only has my book, but just a tons of other great Disney books that I had long before I decided to write one on my own. They can get it there as well.
Again, it's the Walt Disney World That Never Was, stories behind the amazing Imagineering dreams that never came true. So, Chris, thanks so much for starting the week with us here on the show, and we'll have to come back. We have so much more to talk about. I love this stuff. So you come back and talk to us again?
Absolutely, Mike. You just say when.
All right. Roll Tide, buddy. Have a good one.
Thanks a lot.
Sorry, all wrong fans. Those are, all right. And don't forget today's show. It's a Monday brought to you by our great friends over at touringplans.com. So stay out of lines. See the most amount of attractions possible on the next Walt Disney World, Disneyland, or Universal Vacation. Check them out today over at touringplans.com. We're also brought to you by another great book. We're like the library for the Disney fan today. It's The Wisdom of Walt, and it's in the same vein almost, because it's the story of Disneyland and how Walt Disney himself formed Disneyland in his ideas, and he left us lessons that can help you live a better life. You know, there's so many lessons in how Walt Disney persevered and didn't give up and plussed every attraction, just kept going, and it was never done. It was never good enough. You read all these lessons, there's like little checkpoints in there. You can see, how can I apply this to my life to make tomorrow better than today? And it's just a great read for any Disney fan. So check it out today. Grab a personally signed copy over at thewisdomofwalt.com. Give us a follow on the social media. We're on Instagram and Twitter at BeOurGuestMike. And join the Facebook group. Lots of great conversation going on there every day at facebook.com/BeOurGuestPodcast. All right, time to get out of here and let you get on with your Monday. Thank you so much for checking in. We'll be back again on Wednesday answering more of your listener questions. So for Chris, Ricky, and Pam, I'm Mike, wishing you a great Monday. Get back to work, and we'll see you real soon.
You've been listening to the Be Our Guest Walt Disney World Trip Planning Podcast. If you have questions, comments, or would like to be a guest on the show, please visit our website at BeOurGuestPodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you real soon.